This evening, we have tuned in for Parsha Under Pressure. This is a new beginning, a new cycle. Although I should note, the first shiur I gave, Parsha Under Pressure, last year was actually Parsha Noach. So this is the first time I'm doing Bereshit Under Pressure. So if I crack, forgive me, under all that pressure. So I'll begin with a question. True or false? Bereshit is the longest Parsha.
False.
False.
Everybody's in on false, huh? Which one's the longest parsha?
Balotcha.
Is that the case, Balotcha?
No.
Nasa. That's pretty long. Nasa is the marathon one. Having said that, that was a trick question of which you all cleverly fell into. Nasa covers...
Each day is
2,000. Is the longest in time.
Oh.
Precious is the longest in time.
There we go.
Yes.
Indeed. So if you look at Naso or Balotcha, you're talking actually about covering, I don't know, a day. How long is Naso? It's talking about the procession of the judges. It's talking about a week. Bereshit is the longest parasha in the Torah because it covers over 1,000 years. It is way and above the longest parasha that we have. The whole the book of Bereshit covers the most amount of time of all the books, and of all the parashas, Bereshit covers the longest. Adam lives 930 years, Noah is born, his sons are born, so we've covered 1,000 years by the time we get to the end of the parasha, and it's only 7 aliyahs. It's a lot of time to cover. And it's also quite dramatic, the narrative. There's a lot of changes. Naso is, you're right, the longest, and it's basically repetitive. We've got a couple of details about Nazir and Sotah along the way. But Bereshit, we have the creation of the cosmos, the formation of humankind, the invitation into Eden, the sin, the expulsion from Eden. There's a snake along the way that makes a little bit of an impact on human destiny. We've got the birth of the first children, the first murder. We've got the first city. We've got the invention of tongs and tools. It's a bustling parasha. So let's do a little overview, and then we'll go to one particular pasuk and put a little bit of pressure. So as I say, we begin, and it's hard to imagine the background, because the opening pasuk, Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim ve'et ha-aretz, in the beginning, God created the world, the universe, the cosmos, heavens, and earth. And then we're told, Haita tohu vavohu, there was chaos, and murmurs, al pnei ha-tahom, over the deep. Now, is that before creation, or that was the first creation? Did God create chaos, or is that a description of existence before creation happened?
Well, how could anything exist without God creating it?
I think that makes a compelling logic, right? Meaning, obviously, before God created anything, there was nothing. So you're telling me the first thing God created was chaos? It's astonishing. Right? Greek myth, Lahavdil, suggests that the universe began in chaos, but then order somehow evolved out of that. We're suggesting, HaKadosh Baruch is suggesting in the very second verse that chaos was part of creation, that it was intended to be the matter out of which order arose. And it's worth plumbing why that would be the case. We're not going to do that all now, but it's worth thinking about, again, around the Shabbat table. You could suggest to each other, to your families, why would God create chaos to begin with? So we've got Tohu Vavohu, we've got chaos, and then the very first creation, which is?
Light.
You're right. I just said chaos was the first creation, but traditionally the first creation is light. It's worth noting, I think I've mentioned in the past, the first thing that actually happens is speech, because it says Vayihi Or, Yihi Or, and then there was light. So God doesn't have to speak, meaning there's no one in the room. I'm sure many of us have been embarrassed to be standing in an elevator talking to ourselves, and someone opens the door and we have to go as if we weren't talking to ourselves, because it's kind of odd to talk to yourself. Usually it's after another conversation, I wish I would have said this or whatever it was. But God is in an empty cosmos. He's formed chaos, and he says, let there be light. Echoes around the cosmos, and everyone wonders, what on earth are you doing? Why are you speaking? And again, it is worth plumbing why every one of these creations was choreographed the way it was. that there's chaos initially, then God speaks. Actually, I did not plan this. This book called The Murmuring Deep by Aviva Zornberg is actually, it's the title was inspired by an article my uncle wrote. He's a psychoanalyst in London, and he also does some biblical commentary sparingly. And he suggested that actually Tehom should not be translated just as deep, but as the murmuring deep. There's a connotation of sound. Mahuma means a murmur. Tehom does not just mean deep, it means Tehom, Mahuma. And she suggests that actually silence, usually we say that you've got to break the silence. But here the suggestion is that silence broke. There was noise, and then for words to exist, there had to be a silence. So God had to create this chaos out of which we could then forge a moment of calm and reflection, out of which then words could form. So the first thing that happens, chaos, God speaks. Speech is central to the act of creation. According to rabbinic tradition, God forged the world in 10 utterances, Asar Ma Marot. Again, it's odd. Why does God need to speak? But there is an association of creativity with language, that we can make worlds with language. And I think we've probably all experienced ways in which a simple word can shift the way we think about life. I mean, this happened to me the other day. I won't say where or by whom, but you can be in a certain mood. Someone can make an off-the-cuff remark or say something quite pointedly, and it can entirely shift your day. And it's odd, because they just moved their lips and a little bit of noise came out. Nobody touched me. I didn't move. And my life is altered. My day is altered. My mood then spreads and shifts, either for good or bad. And words have immense power. And it's quite possible that that is what's being insinuated here in the creation of the cosmos through words. Vayihi or let there be light. And it's quite possible Yehi or is actually a remark, and the Hasidic thinkers suggest that what was the light? The light was language. God said, let there be light. Vayihi or is not saying, and then after he spoke, light popped into the world. But it's a comment on what just took place. God said, yehi or, and the comment is, vayihi or, and there was light. That language that can illuminate our experience is exactly what was forged at that moment. A lot of the Hasidic commentaries are fascinating on creation because in many ways, the creation is not intended to be a science. A scientific description of how the world unfolded. I'll note Rav Amital, who was Rosh Yeshiva in Gush when I was there, and before that, of course, passed away, I think 10 years ago it was this year. Somebody once asked him a question about creation, and he had a very pithy way of responding, and he said, Ani lo hevanti shum davar mebereshit ad lech lecha. He says, I don't understand a thing. From Bereshit to Lech Lecha, don't ask me any questions. Anyway, so, which was a remark that this doesn't overlap with science necessarily, in which case it's a very odd evolution of information. And what are we meant to do with it? Which begs the question that is a traditional question. Why are we starting here? Why not start with the story of Abraham? Traditionally, we say, why not start with the first mitzvah? But I think we've probably all come to a place where we recognize the import of narrative and story and history. But if it is a book that involves law and narrative, why start with the creation of chaos and light and dark and vegetation? That has literally nothing to do with the way I should live my life, it seems. It doesn't offer me a particularly accurate scientific history. It doesn't offer me an ethic per se. It doesn't describe the unfolding of human nature. Why do I need to know when the sun or the moon was made? And these are important questions. And I'll say, what's the traditional answer why we start with Bereshit? Does anybody know Rashi's answer? The what first question Zalachem? Rashi asks. Go on, Steve.
Bereshit Zalachem.
Say again?
Should start with the first mitzvah.
Right. So the question is, why not start with HaChodesh HaZelachem, Rosh Chodeshim? That we should start really in Parashat Bo, after you've left Egypt. And what's Rashi's answer? Why do we start now with Bereshit?
God to gave show us, the land to the Jews.
To show us that Hashem did everything.
Yeah. There so be told you're on the money. Say it again, Steve.
We can move the embassy.
Excellent. Yes, Rashi says so that the embassy can be in Yerushalayim. Exactly. So it's interesting. You know that I was about to make the connection. How many? I mean, let's just package it. Rashi's answer is, why did we start with Bereishis? To show the world that God formed the universe so he can decide who's going to live where. He gives us the land of Israel. He's got all the rights in the world to do that. Now, talking of moving the embassy to Jerusalem, how many people do you imagine will be convinced or persuaded when they're having a debate about the Middle East and Jewish colonialists? You take out a Bible and you say, well, read this. God made the universe and he gave it to us. How many of them are going to pack their bags and say, I didn't know. I'm so sorry. Thank you for sharing that with me. I'm going to go home. I'm going to find a new cause. I think the answer is none. No one's going to be convinced by that, which tells you two things. Number one, that answer is not compelling in our day and age. That does not provide a way for us to understand why we start with Bereishis in 2020, because no one finds that persuasive, number one. Number two, what does that tell us? Assuming that Rashi is not just throwing things up, that was persuasive in the 1100s. And that tells you how far we've moved in human culture, which is what we were speaking about in the Sacred Text Under Threat series at Sudar Shlishit, which is the idea that the biblical text was not persuasive on its face is relatively new. That was the 1700s when biblical criticism came to the fore, when the Enlightenment and Romantics kind of shredded and rehabilitated the biblical text and reappropriated it in different ways, that it became a story, or it became dramatic, or it became incoherent to modern secular figures. But in 1100, in 1300, the text was on its face persuasive. If you showed me a verse, that proved a point. Talking of competing town halls, and debates, the disputations of the medieval period were over who has the more convincing version of scripture. Again, if you said, I mean, they do ask presidential candidates occasionally, what's your favorite verse? Which there always leads to entertaining responses. I'm not going to forget in 2016, when there was about 19 Republican candidates, one of the ones who hung in right till the end, John Kasich, I think, from Ohio, was the governor of Ohio. He went to a matzah factory in Brooklyn, and he lifted up matzahs. I guess it was around Pesach time in the primary season. And I remember him like reaching up and saying, I want to thank you so much for your hospitality. The Jewish community is wonderful. You've given me these Passover breads, and I have to say it reminds me of the blood of Jesus. And I just want to thank you so much. I'm thinking someone needs to give him a little bit of cultural background. They did not take that as a compliment. Half of them spat in the side when he said that. So it has entertaining results. And then actually the same video had John Kasich walking into a store. He was trying to canvass for votes, I guess, in Brooklyn. He went into a store and asked one of the kids what they're learning. And he said, what's your favorite passage? What are you studying right now? Because he's presumably a religious man. And they said, Hilcha Shavus. And he said, oh, well, Joseph is my favorite figure. And they go, oh, Yosef, yeah. It's a funny exchange. Either way, in America, to be honest, the Bible is still quite a persuasive, compelling public text. Probably of all the Western countries, America is the most enmeshed in religious faith. I think the statistic is more Americans proportionally go to church every Sunday than Muslims go to mosque in Iran every Friday. So in some ways, America is more religious than some of these theocracies. Either way, in 1100, in Europe, the biblical text, beginning with Bereishit, saying God created the world, was a persuasive argument as to why you should let us go to where we want. So that tells you something about then and about now. But we're still left in 2020 with, well, why are we starting with Bereishis? If that's not a compelling argument anymore, have we now hollowed out the power of beginning with the creation of the cosmos? And of course, the answer is never. We've hollowed out the power of the biblical text. We have to figure out a way to make it compelling. you're welcome to offer thoughts as well. It's actually interesting. Philo, who is not a form of pastry, but an early Jewish philosopher. Philo, do you call it Philo or Philo pastry here?
Philo.
Philo pastry. That joke only works in America. In England, I think they call it Philo pastry. So I think it's spelt differently as well. It's with an F. So Philo with a PH of Alexandria was a Jewish philosopher, biblical commentator. Most astonishing. He's quite well known, being very influential in biblical commentary, early Jewish philosophy. He, we assume, did not know how to read Hebrew. And all his reading and commentary was done in Greek translation, which is astonishing on its face. There were a whole group, I was going to say sect, but it's not entirely aligned ideologically, a whole group of Alexandrian Hellenistic Jews that lived in Greek translation in the same way that many Jews today live in English translation. And you've got very thoughtful people writing commentaries. Leon Cass wrote a commentary on Genesis called The Beginning of Wisdom. A number of figures writing commentaries who don't read Hebrew well. Either way, so Philo, the pastry chef, suggests with his old science that actually the biblical text begins with the cosmos unfolding in creation and then leans later into law and legislation as a pedagogical lesson to teach us that if we want to be productive human beings, we need to learn sciences, natural sciences, physical sciences, chemical sciences, before we learn morality. We need to have a grounding in fact, in a shared world of information before we can have conversation and form moral community. So that's his way of resolving that. Again, we're left almost without being able to use that because it doesn't map over to the science.
What about Rambam's view of creation?
Go on.
Well, allegedly he claims that it was an allegory.
Excellent. So I was actually just going to come to the Rambam, to Maimonides. And in some ways, his suggestion in the Moreh Nevuch, in the Guide for Perplexed, can still be quite compelling. And for Rambam, it's complicated. And I guess we can do after sacred texts under threat officially finishes, as opposed to just gets interrupted, we can do some of the medieval controversies around interpreting the text. But Rambam essentially viewed allegory as the proper method of interpretation across the board for the biblical text. This is what led to pushback against him. A number of the more traditional Jews who refuted allegory ended up burning the Rambam's work, living to regret it in some cases. Rabbeinu Yonah, one of the commentaries on the biblical on the Talmudic text, on the Talmud, quotes Maimonides on almost every page. And in his introduction, he says, "I do this because I was part of the group that had Rambam's books burned, and I regret it deeply. And now I insist on citing his view on every page that I comment on." So Rambam viewed a lot of things allegorically, as an example. And what's complicated is, the Rambam would have to say, "I'm not saying the text isn't literal. I'm just saying that it's given to us for the allegorical purpose, as an example that one could find controversial." He suggests that Avraham and Sarah allegorically represent form and matter, as in the Aristotelian discussion of form and matter. And he says Avraham and Sarah represent those two forces. Now, if you take an allegorical reading, suddenly, oh, so maybe Avraham and Sarah never existed. Maybe it's not a history, it's just an allegorical document, which of course is what led to the controversies and the pushback and the intolerance. How can the Rambam say this? At which point the allegorical schools became very muted because it was not tolerated by the Jewish masses. So Rambam suggests that a lot of this can be read in allegorical level. He suggests we begin with Bereshit, as an ethic. As I said at the beginning, why are we being told this information? It's not scientific. It doesn't give me an ethic. It doesn't portray history. The Rambam denies that. He says there is an ethic here. Why do we begin with God saying on day one, "I said this, I did this, it was night, it was morning, day one"? Why do we do that? Maimonides says it is one of the earliest, most important foundational ethics we need. Philo says we should learn science. Rambam is not talking about that. Rambam says It tells us we need to live an ordered life. It teaches us to be organized. God is saying, if you want to live productively as an ethical being with a moral compass, you need to have a sense of order and organization. You need to know what's happening on one day, what's happening on the next day. And I say this, which none of you can see, but right behind my computer, there is a pile of I don't know what on the desk. But maybe there's an ethic I should, every couple of months we throw everything out and then we pile it up again and then we throw it out and then we pile it up again. Hopefully I'll be rid of this by a couple of months' time. I did take the schach off the top of the sukkah today. That was exciting. The walls are going to have to wait for Pesach. So we've got through almost the creation. And of course, there's a lot to say about each part of creation, a lot to be said. I see Linda's got in the background there. You've got the globe, the earth. There's a lot of discussion about day one and day four overlapping, two and five and three and six. Of course, day six is the creation of humankind. What becomes complicated, I'm trying to figure out how to cover this material, right off the bat, there is a problem. There is a contradiction. Anybody read Rabbi Soloveitchik's, let's start again. Anybody heard of Rabbi Soloveitchik's Lonely Man of Faith?
Yeah.
Anybody seen a copy of the book?
Yes.
Anybody opened the copy of the book?
Yes.
Anybody read more than five pages of the book?
No.
Okay, there we go. No. The truth is, in honesty, I don't remember if I've read the whole book. I certainly didn't the first time. I got through about 10 pages the first time, and I made a couple of attempts at it. I may have got to the end at some point, but it's been a while since I attempted. But summaries are always helpful. So for those of you who are familiar, even if you haven't read from beginning to end, but you're familiar with the structure, it was actually published, I think, initially as a tradition article, as an essay, and then they published it as a book. If you have the book, the page is big font, large spaces, huge margins, because it's a small essay, but they don't want to sell a packet, so they peck it out. And I guess you can make notes around it. So what is, pun I guess intended, the genesis of the essay? For those of you who are familiar, what is it that sparks Lonely Man of Faith? Okay, so I guess I should have taken the cue when you said you hadn't read it. So the essence of the book is, if we were to boil it down, his basic argument is human beings have two identities within us. We have a creative, active part of us, and we have the more spiritual, naive, mysterious part of us. In many ways, we have the enlightenment part of us and we have the romantic part of us. I don't want to overuse that division, but that's what it comes down to. And he calls these two personas that we all have Adam 1 and Adam 2. And Adam 1 is the lonely, isolated, religious, spiritual being that is lost in naivety and sentiment and needs company. And the Adam 2 is the part of us that is creative and active and goes around building with projects, political being. That's Adam 2. And it's quite a profound description of the complex psyche of the human being. But it has a genesis. There is a reason. He doesn't just invent this and start speculating on psyche. It's essentially a commentary on the first two chapters of Genesis, of Bereshit, which is resolving an issue. Because in the first two chapters, we have a contradiction. What's the contradiction between chapter 1 and chapter 2? Or let's say, what is repeated from chapter 1 and chapter 2?
You know it.
Yeah, Hachab was created.
There you go, Ora. Yes, correct. Oh, say again?
I'm sorry, I was talking to Yona. He was asking me if I knew it, and I said, I think I know
it. And you said,
I didn't even realize I was unmuted.
Well, there you go. It slipped, and you got it right. Indeed, the story of the creation of Adam and Eve is told twice. And I encourage you this Shabbat, it's a long laning, have a look at the English of chapter 1 and chapter 2 of Bereshit. We are told in chapter 1, God created man and woman together. And then in chapter 2, we're told God created Adam. And Adam named the animals. And Adam felt lonely. And Adam didn't know what to do. And Adam said, I need some company. And God said, it's not good for man to be alone. And God created Eve. Didn't you just tell me in chapter 1 that you created Zachar and Nekeva, Hibara Am? It says they were created, man and woman. Now, you could suggest that was kind of the Spark Notes version, and then there's an elaboration, which some suggest. But they seem like entirely different stories. And after the emancipation of the Jews, with the Enlightenment, with the sacred text under threat, this was precisely one of the moments where biblical critics said, this is obviously evidence that the biblical text is not divine, that this is a mashed together, redacted version of different myths and stories that was patched together. And you have one ancient tradition of a creation story where man and woman are created together. And you've got another tradition where man was lonely and then God reacted, and the redactors kind of mushed it together to preserve both traditions. Now, even logically speaking, I would suggest that the argument's somewhat weak. If you're a redactor and you're trying to produce a good narrative, I imagine in the first chapter you're going to get rid of redundancies, right? Meaning sometimes you need a copy editor to look over your work, but usually the first couple sentences you've got grammatically worked out. It seems like an odd choice for a redactor to kind of make a mess or an inconsistency that early. So putting logic aside, of course, our faith and our tradition don't rely on logic to defend this being a sacred text. And Rabbi Soloveitchik says this repetition and inconsistency was intentional. It is describing, again, just in the way that the 7 days of creation is not aligned with evolution or potentially the science of creation. It was to teach an ethic of some sort. These two stories are also trying to communicate an ethic about the human condition. It's not to outline the history of how man was created, which raises the question then, well, what is the history? Were we created together or one after the other? I think all of us in our minds imagine Adam first being created and then out of a rib, Eve being created, because that's the most elaborate story. For Rabbi Soloveitchik, in Lonely Man of Faith, this is the whole book in essence. There are two creation narratives because there are two personas in each human being. And what he does is, and it's called The Lonely Man of Faith. Somebody 5 years ago, I think, published a book called The Lonely Woman of Faith, objecting to the masculinity and the patriarchal versions of this story, which are, I guess, reasonable pushback, because he suggests The Lonely Man of Faith, Adam is representative of humankind. Eve is almost a sideshow in his A Lonely Man of Faith. He says it's necessary for the story, but Adam represents every human being, man and woman. And Eve is there to communicate part of this ethic that we need company and that we feel lonely. But he suggests that there are these two parts, these two personas to every human being. We have Adam 1 and we have Adam 2. We have this creative part to our nature and this naive, mysterious, spiritual part of our nature. And we try to muddle our way through. So the whole Lonely Man of Faith isn't just a philosophical tract. It's a commentary on what begins Bereshit. And I should note, just for the record, that the Malbim has a reading of this too, which is eerily similar to the Lonely Man of Faith in different vernacular, different formulation, in one of his sermons, which we'll get to. And I should note, this Shabbat afternoon, there'll be two minchas at shul. One a little earlier with time for people to go home and have Suda Shlishit, and then there'll be a later one without Suda Shlishit in Shul, but so it'll be pushed right up against Shkia, and then there'll be a small Shir between Mincha and Maariv. My plan is to rehabilitate the sacred text under threat series without the food. So I can only apologize for that. And I think we're calling it Malbim's Morals. So it feels like it's not just a kind of hobbling version of what happened, but it's essentially going to pick up where we left off with the Malbim's sermons. So that'll be Shabbos afternoon. One day maybe we'll get to his reading of this scene, because Malbim, again, in 1839, 100 years before Rabbi Soloveitchik is born, no, that's not true. He was born in 1933. I was going to say 33, born 1903. So it was not 100 years, but 70 years before he was born. He wrote that there, in one of his sermons, there are two scenes of creation. What is this for? And he then lies out that there is the part of human existence upon which we require coordination. We need to build a house. I mean, to build my sukkah. I needed my father-in-law to coincidentally be here to help with babysitting, to help me hold one of the wolves when I put the other one up. I tried a few times, but I've only got two hands, and I'm not really that athletic as it begins. So sometimes we need coordination and we need assistance. And the Malbim describes to live in society, you need that. But there's another part of us, the spiritual part of us, that actually soars best in isolation. And those are the two stories he creates. And then he goes on to describe how this has an impact theologically and morally. But maybe we'll get to that on a Shabbat afternoon in a couple months' time. Either way, that's the first two prakim. Then, of course, after the creation of humankind, they go into the Garden of Eden. There's a sin that takes place. Who eats the apple first?
She does.
She does. I'm not apportioning any blame. I'm just getting the facts out there. Eve eats the apple. Then what does she do?
Gives it to Adam.
Gives it. What does she give to Adam? Yes, I like the way you said it. What does she give to Adam?
Fruit.
Oh, I guess I should ask, what did she eat?
Not an apple.
You said not an apple?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So Christianity has seen it as an apple. Truth is, there are about six different rabbinic traditions, none of which say it's an apple. Anyone know what any of the traditions are about what?
Etrog,
yes. This is one of the first sin fruits. Potentially, there's a view that it was grapes, a very unusual view. Anyone know another view?
Wheat.
Yes, that is the most unusual one, that it was wheat. How does wheat grow on a tree? But that is one of the views. Say that again.
Chet.
You say grapes?
Chet. Sin.
Chet. Oh, chita. Right. I thought you were saying crepe for a while. Well, I thought a tree with crepes on it. That sounds fantastic. If you can get some of the maple syrup on the crepes, that'd be great too. So, yes, there are a number of different traditions. And the reason Christianity associated with an apple, do you know why they picked apple? It's actually an etymological, as far as I understand. I may be wrong. It's an etymological accident. Jay, you have an answer?
Yeah. Mela. The Italian, the Latin word mela.
Means?
An apple or bad. In male, it's very close to mal. Like Maleficent, M-A-L-E.
Great. I was not familiar with this. Is this something you're guessing?
In Italian, it's mangi la mela, eat the apple.
This is something you've read or this is something you're guessing?
Something I read, and I remember it. I was just in Italy 2 years ago, so I remember having this conversation with somebody.
That's fascinating. I was not, it's actually, now that you say it's ringing a little bell, but I never know. I'm just remembering you having told me that a minute ago. So,
that and figs with the other eye.
I don't think he's right.
There's a tradition with figs, that's true. The etymological background that I've come across is that apple in the medieval period was essentially just a synonym for fruit. That's why, what is an apple in French? Anyone know what a potato is in French?
Pomme de terre.
Pomme de terre, which means an apple of the ground. What's it do with an apple of the ground? Apple, pomme, just meant fruit.
Tabukhay adama.
In Hebrew, it's Hebrew, right.
Tabukhay adama.
Tabukhay adama, yeah, they borrowed the French, yeah, that's true. And the word tapuach in biblical Hebrew often also has just the connotation of fruit. Doesn't always mean what we call an apple. What we call an apple is quite specific. But apple, like to be the apple of someone's eye, why an apple? It just means to be the fruit. So when they said it was an apple, it then got carried over etymologically as that word became specific. But it used to just mean fruit. And it does say pri ha'etz, the fruit of the tree in the Hebrew. But Jay has an interesting Italian etymological collection to do with melon or mela, as the case may be. So that's fascinating. So they eat the fruit. I asked Diane, you said she gives it to Adam, which was an interesting formulation, because what it says in the pasuk is v'natan min ha'etz, she gave to him of the tree. There's a book, I don't have a copy, I borrowed one in Chicago from the senior rabbi, called Changing the Immutable. Some of you may be familiar with it. It's by a fellow, I think Mark Shapiro is the name. He's considered somewhat controversial by some. Well, I shouldn't say that. He's considered lovely. Some of his books are considered controversial by some. I think he wrote a book called Must a Jew Believe Anything, which you can now imagine. Oh, okay, I get why that's controversial. You should see the conclusion. So he has a book called Changing the Immutable, where he looks at essentially inner Jewish censorship over time. I think the opening introduction has a picture of the Situation Room around the raid on Osama bin Laden, where you've got the picture, I think, from the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and then the picture as it was in Hamadiyah, where there's somebody missing from the Situation Room. Who was missing?
Hillary.
All right. Hillary Clinton was airbrushed out of the picture. So he uses that, obviously, to kind of get your attention as a contemporary issue. But he then traces censorship, not just over the last 10 years. It's not just a bashing of art scroll. It looks over the last 1,000 years. And one of the things he notes is in a couple of the medieval commentaries, they were, in some of the commentaries, in the opening page, if you have a look, like in modern books, in the front page, you don't usually have much. You have a title. Sometimes you have a nice big title. But in the medieval manuscripts, they would often have pictures. If you think about the inside of any volume of Talmud, of Shas, they've got kind of swirly, kind of decorative gates when you open it up. So if you look at some of the medieval manuscripts, they actually had images of news in the first edition that he shows that were there, and then later published, they kind of, that's why there's a lot of lions. You see a lot of lions in the inside of a lot of these that look somewhat curvaceous and odd for lions. Either way, one of the things he notes is the Baal HaTurim had a number of editions published, some of which left things out. And sometimes it's not malicious censors who are trying to control, but sometimes authors self-censored because they think about what can be handled by the populace. This was not theologically controversial, but his reading, interpretation, Natan lo min ha'et, she gave him from the tree. As Diane said, she gave it to him, meaning she didn't give him fruit. What does it mean? She gave him from the tree. Natan lo min ha'et. I wouldn't expect anybody to guess this. The suggestion of the Baal HaTurim is she beat him with wood until he ate it.
It's on you.
That after Eve or Chava ate, she realized she was in deep trouble. She had altered the cosmos. She'd altered the human nature. And she said to Adam, come and eat. And he said, no. He said, no, I'm not doing that. V'natan lamin ha'et. So she gave him of the tree. She gave him from the tree until he ate. And the Baal HaTurim, it was almost his way of defending Adam's integrity. I'm not entirely sure why it was censored out. He gave some, Shapiro suggested that he didn't want to suggest female dominance and maybe it was uncomfortable socially at the time. But in many ways, it seems to get Adam off the hook and kind of put more blame on Eve. But she beat him until he ate. And it has all sorts of implications that post-eating, post-sin, she becomes vicious and violent. Adam is almost innocent, submissive. And you have there kind of a dynamic of pre and post-sin that you don't really see elsewhere. Most of the commentaries, they both eat, and there's a pre-sin humanity and a post-sin humanity, but you don't get that moment where you get to see them in conversation in between. So I just thought I'd share that with you because it stuck with me when I saw it. It's an interesting a suggestion. I see it's 8:57. We're not going to put under pressure the passage I selected, which is fine because please God, we'll have another time to do that and we'll do that. But we haven't even got up to Cain and Hevel. But that just speaks to how compact the narrative is here, where we go from being, we haven't even got to them hiding in the forest yet, which I should say, it says they went to hide. Where did they go to hide? I just told you in the forest, I can't remember the Hebrew. So I was hoping somebody could jump in. Because they went, lechabot ba, maybe
ba'isim.
What does it say?
The field.
Well, it says they went to the field, but it says they hid among the trees.
Hagan.
Field.
Went to the garden.
Atzei Hagan. I think it says Atzei Hagan. You can check it out
Hagan.
Later. It just says they went to hide in the garden. Doesn't say the Atse Hagan. Someone's going to have to check that up for me. Because this is used by the medievals to suggest that actually that's one of the sources why we use wooden coffins.
So they went
the Eitz Hagan. There you go. They went to hide in the wood of the garden. And it was almost like a death wish. They went to kind of bury themselves in shame, which again has all sorts of implications that should be the source. And I should know in Israel that it's not the custom to bury wooden coffins. This was when wood was customary, depending on where people live. So you've got them going to hide in the garden among the trees. God comes and they heard a voice in the garden before God came, which if we're talking about etiquette, and I guess as we wrap up in the last minute, and some of you may go to watch dueling town halls, we should finish with a note of etiquette. Before God said something, he comes down with some of the most accusative language. Ayeka, where are you? Which, of course, generates theological questions about omniscience and what God knows and doesn't know. But before he speaks and confronts them, and Adam and Eve deny it, they hear a kol b'gan. There is a voice that's kind of moving around the garden, which is when they go, oh, he's coming. Anybody got a ring, like on your door, a ring? Like they hit it and your phone buzzes sometimes before the ring goes. And that's what happened. Before someone was there, they heard the voice. And the Radak suggests, why is there a voice? Is it just kind of, is it part of what it means to be God that a voice precedes you? And he suggests that actually this was God again offering an ethic of etiquette, that you should not crash in on someone. And it's as simple as that. Why is there a voice in the Garden of Eden? Radak says, to teach us to knock on the door. That's what it is, to teach us that you knock before walking in on someone, just to show respect. That even though he's obviously, so to speak, enraged with humankind who have sinned, there is a dignity and respect, even in rage, to give people space, give people time, let people have expectation. And it is on that note of dignity and respect, even as people disagree vociferously, that I invite you all to have a wonderful Shabbat and to enjoy what remains of what I imagine has been edifying television. I wish you all, as I say, a wonderful Shabbat. I'll sit here if you're not switching over. I'm happy to take comments, thoughts. I see Jay's just posted something with Wikipedia in the chat. Does it have the Italian comment?
It has multiple comments, including some of the Latin comment. Yes.
Wonderful. Okay, so everyone should
feel free. Just a nice place to look at them.
Great. Have a click on the Wikipedia, and as I say, you are all no longer captive. So I wish you all a wonderful Shabbat.